I'm JG Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
They say that actually, every time that I enter the ring, in a way, I'm going to war. They say to me daily, you are a prize fighter. What's the difference? And I like to say to those critics of the press and to the others that there is one hell of a lot of difference in fighting in the ring and going to war in Vietnam. Boxing is nothing like going to war with machine guns, bazookas, hand grenades, bomber airplanes. My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people. That's what the business is in war. I would like to hear this from you. And I want the world and the cameras to hear. Who's the heavyweight champion of the world?
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. What you just heard was audio from a speech given by the boxing legend, the all-time great of the sport, Muhammad Ali, about his opposition to the Vietnam War and his controversial refusal to serve in the military during that conflict. I thought that starting out the show with that particular clip would be rather appropriate, since we are going to be talking on this edition of the program about both boxing and politics. Our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn, author of the new book, The Bitter Sweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Dr. Horn joins us on this edition of the program to uncover the connections between professional boxing, capitalism, labor exploitation, and settler colonialism, among other things. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to the conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of, again, The Bitter Sweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Welcome to Parallax Views, Professor Gerald Horn, author of the fascinating new book, The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. And yourself?
I am doing really great, and I'm really enjoying this book. I know you're known for some of your really incisive and insightful writing on settler colonialism, and I want to get into maybe how this all ties together with your prior work on that subject. But with regards to the title of this new effort, The Bittersweet Science, for my listeners that are unfamiliar with boxing, that's a play on the term the sweet science. Maybe you could explain to my listeners, why is boxing called the sweet science, and why do you refer to it as the bittersweet science?
Well, the term sweet science was popularized by the late New Yorker writer A.J. Liebling, And he used that term because boxing, if you are able to abstract out the violence, the racketeering, the racism, is actually a lovely sport to watch. You had a number of boxers, for example, who in their defensive skill are able to get their opponent to defeat themselves. And that involves a certain kind of what might be called chess tactics inside the ring. Now, I use the term bittersweet science because I do not abstract out the violence, the racketeering, the racism, the brain damage. That's at the heart of my project. And the sweet science is only secondarily at the heart of my project.
So, out of curiosity, how did this project come about, considering your previous books, like The Dawning of the Apocalypse and your work on settler colonialism? How does this come about, and how does it tie together with your previous work?
Well, the thread that unites this book with previous work that I've done involves racism. My work on settler colonialism and slavery obviously involves racism. If you look at the question of racketeering, I did a book on the music we call jazz, which had racketeering at the heart of it. I did a book on Hollywood that had racketeering at the heart of it. So that's connective tissue. Now, on the other hand, it's apparent that this book, in a sense, diverges from past work insofar as it's engaging sports, which is not something I've engaged at book length up to this point. But I've had a long interest in sports, and I was looking around for a sports topic to write about. And since I already knew quite a bit about boxing, it seemed to be the logical choice.
I want to add to that, too, that I was looking at the back of the book, and there's some praise for it from Ishmael Reed, who was actually just on our program. He writes, "A great book. My head kept snapping as though I'd received uppercuts. In The Bittersweet Science, Gerald Horn exposes the filthy world of boxing. He outs the criminals and racists who control the sport and reveals the sad outcomes of those black boxers who, though victorious in the ring, were exploited." I consider Ishmael Reed to be doing sort of similar work to you in some ways. I think you both provide a counter-narrative to a lot of sort of the myths that we in America are fed through our culture, our education system. Do you think that when it comes to boxing, there is this untold story that figures like yourself and Ishmael Reed, who wrote, of course, The Complete Muhammad Ali, are drawn to for that reason? There's this whole underbelly that really doesn't get exposed that often.
Well, certainly that's the case for Ishmael. You may be familiar with this play that's a send-up and spoof of Hamilton, which, of course, has earned millions on Broadway and through Disney streaming. And to an extent, I guess you could place me in the same category, insofar as I, too, am trying to expose and explode mythology. But of course, that's a job that takes an army of writers and scholars in this country. And certainly boxing is a subject worthy of expose insofar as it has ensnared not only countless numbers of Black Americans, Jewish Americans, Latinx boxers, and has also featured prominently a number of leading exploiters, including the former President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, who promoted boxing during his life as a casino mogul in Atlantic City, and not to mention the current promoters like Don King and Bob Arum, both in the land of the living, although in their 80s. And so boxing also has featured prominently a number of politicians like Harry Reid, the former Senate leader from Nevada, got his start as a boxer. Berry Gordy, the music mogul, Motown Records, of course, is his proud creation. Nelson Mandela was a boxer. So I think because of boxing's prominence on the one hand and the shameless exploitation that it has engendered on the other, it becomes prime territory for an expose.
So where would you say that we should start with regards to the connection between race and boxing? In discussing that, do we look at how, you know, you mentioned there were Jewish boxers, Italian-American, Latino, Black. It seems as if it was a place where men could show their athletic talent, where otherwise they really didn't get to participate in, you know, the sort of WASP America. So a lot of people got into boxing. Or do you think that we can trace the sort of racial component to boxing even further back?
Well, first of all, boxing is one of the oldest sports known to humans. I mean, I guess you could group it with track and field, particularly running. Running is a sport that almost inheres in our species. It's a rapid form of walking, if you like. And you could say the same for boxing insofar as it basically distills a certain kind of conflict, and it doesn't require that much equipment. I mean, if you're playing ice hockey, for example, you need a certain amount of equipment, skates not least. If you are involved in baseball, you need a bat, ball, and glove. Boxing is altogether different. And so you can trace boxing back thousands of years to China. I start my book because Black Americans are a leading topic in my book. I start my book on the shores of Africa and talk about how there was the development of certain martial arts and certain combative skills in Africa that was congruent with the rise of the African slave trade. I point, for example, to capoeira, which, to the best of our knowledge, develops in southwestern Africa, but receives its efflorescence in Brazil. It's a kind of martial arts come choreography. And I put forward the idea that this kind of martial arts that develop in Africa is a direct response to fighting enslavers, for example, who descend upon Africa with a maniacal energy of crazed bees in the 1500s in particular, which of course was the subject of a book that I did on the 1500s. And so I also deal with the battle royal during the times of slavery. You may recall that this was a, quote, sport, unquote, in which young Black men, 8 or 9, perhaps a few less, perhaps a few more, were blindfolded and put in the ring, and the one that emerges gets a prize. Bo Jack, who was a leading Black lightweight of the 1940s and early 1950s, got his start in Augusta, Georgia, the home of James Brown, as some of your listeners may know, the late great singer and dancer. Bo Jack got his start with the Battle Royal, battling for the entertainment of former slave owners in Augusta, Georgia. And then during the time of slavery itself, Black men in particular were often pitted against each other for the enjoyment and entertainment of slaveholders. And so I make the argument that in terms of trying to understand how Black men in particular have excelled in boxing, I think it does us little good to look at these so-called nature arguments, that there's something inherent in their physiognomy or genetics that allows them to excel. I recall having a debate on that topic with regard to that issue. And I asked my interlocutor, well, if Black American men are so great at running and track, and supposedly this is due to physiognomy and genetics, well, where are the West African sprinters, for example? I mean, obviously they haven't received the training, which obviously points to nurture. It seems to be an easy argument to make, but once again, as noted, we are in the land of the United States where mythology oftentimes prevails over fact. I should also say that there is a particular issue of masculinity involved with regard to the book that I write. What I mean is, even though it's lost in the mystic chords of memory or history, the fact is that it was not so long ago that Black men in particular were derided and berated because supposed real men don't allow themselves to be enslaved or allow themselves, quote unquote, of course, to be subjected to Jim Crow and U.S. apartheid. And these Black Americans were oftentimes derided and berated as being yellow-bellied cowards, for example. So that obviously put a chip on the shoulders of many Black American men who felt that they had to prove that they were real men, which they did in the ring. And then, of course, the flip side of that argument, these kinds of fictitious arguments oftentimes have a flip side, is that these Black American men were actually brutes and beasts. And you see that trope emerging as they begin to excel in the ring. In fact, Sonny Liston, some of your listeners may be familiar with him. He is portrayed in the award-winning movie One Night in Miami, which deals with his defeat at the hands of the then Cassius Clay, now Muhammad Ali, in 1964. He was explicitly castigated as a beast and a brute by many illiterate sports writers. So that's the backstory to some of the early chapters of this book.
With regards to those battle royales and, these Black fighters being pitted against each other for the entertainment of these white men, do you think there's also a sort of political or psychological strategy going on there? You sort of divide these fighters or these people so that they don't overthrow the white supremacists?
Well, sure. I mean, divide and conquer, which was honed to a fairly well by the British Empire, to a certain extent has been used not only by the British Empire and their spawn on the West Bank of the Atlantic, speaking of the United States of America, but I would say by outnumbered exploiters everywhere. What I mean is, if you look at Britain, it has a contemporary population of about 65 million, and it was ruling British India, as it was then called, which has a contemporary population of about, 1.5 billion, for example. You can't do that unless you're able to hone and perfect the tools of divide and conquer. And so certainly by pitting these Black men against each other in the ring, that particular stratagem was certainly at play.
Now, with regards to boxing, specifically in the United States, where do we see the sort of rise of the Black boxer? Who are some of the figures that you discuss in the book? And what does it all contend for white America at the time?
Well, one of the leading figures is Jack Johnson, born in 1878 in Galveston, Texas. And he has been the subject of numerous books and movies. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the movie The Great White Hope, with James Earl Jones, the actor, playing Jack Johnson. He was notorious, not least because in 1910, he upset the apple cart of white male supremacy by becoming the heavyweight boxing champion. And that was a major upset because here he was getting paid handsomely to crush the skulls of these Euro-American men. And of course, if you had thought about that outside of the ring, you could be subjected to a lynching. And so this led to a search for a so-called great white hope, that is to say, a Euro-American man or European man, or even there was a search for a great white hope in Asia, which suggested to me, at least, that at play as much as anything else was putting the Negro in his place, as much as finding a so-called white man to defeat him. And not being able to accomplish that goal, he had criminal charges hung around his neck because he had a proclivity for consorting with Euro-American women, which inflamed the furor of some even more. And he was indicted on federal charges and found it necessary to flee the United States, wound up in Europe. He called Barcelona his favorite city. He spends time there also in the 1930s. The time I'm talking about now is the second decade of the 20th century, that is to say about 1910 to 1920. He won the championship in 1910, for example, in Reno, Nevada. And he also spent time during that tumultuous decade in revolutionary Mexico. Mexico was undergoing the Mexican Revolution at that time, and he was attempting to establish a beachhead south of the border for the undermining of U.S. Jim Crow. Jack Johnson, like other heavyweight champions, up to and including Muhammad Ali, was politicized. However, you had regime change in Mexico City, and he had to come back to the United States and face the music and serve the jail term. And by then, his boxing skills were withering. It's not unlike, once again, what befell Muhammad Ali in the 1960s when he refused to be conscripted for the war in Vietnam and was stripped of a license to box during the height of his pugilistic skills. However, after a two-year hiatus, he was able, or two or three or four-year hiatus, he was able to return to the ring, albeit a bit rusty, but still not far from the peak of his excellence. Jack Johnson, of course, went on after his boxing career took a nosedive to become a sort of song and dance man. He played the bass fiddle. He had a number of skills.
And I was also going to add another figure from this period is Joe Gans. How do these two figures really change the landscape for boxing in America? And maybe we could also discuss how this Great White Hope sort of narrative, it seems to emerge over and over again. It emerged, I feel like, a few years back with the Floyd Mayweather Conor McGregor fight. I felt like there was a Great White Hope narrative being advertised in that very stealthily in some ways. What do you think about this Great White Hope narrative and why it keeps reoccurring?
I think it keeps reoccurring because it taps into something deep and profound in the construction of settler colonialism. That is to say, you may recall that the English, the people whose language we're now speaking, they were able to establish a foothold in what they call Virginia in 1607. However, from the inception of these settlements, there was conflict, and the conflict inhered in a kind of model of development whereby you were relying upon the unpaid labor of enslaved Africans to build a society, and then depending upon them to a certain degree to ally with you when you had to fight the indigenous population, the Native American populations. That's a very unstable contraption. And the idea that the Black people may not ally with the settlers, and in fact may join the antagonists of the settlers in an attack upon the settlers, I think continues to roil the deepest unconsciousness of the descendants of the settlers, or the settlers themselves, if I may use that phrase. And so when you talk about a so-called Great White Hope, you're talking about the idea of a kind of normative white male supremacy being established and reestablished, which then in turn helps to calm anxieties and nervousness about these potential seditionists and insurrectionists, speaking of Black people, who you're surrounded by. And so I agree with you that many of Floyd Mayweather's fights, not least his conflicts with Conor McGregor, have an odor of that particular trope. And when you look at boxing beginning in the late 1890s and the first decade or so of the 20th century, you see it not only with regard to Jack Johnson, but as you noted, Joe Gans, who in many ways was viewed as one of the first of the scientific boxers, insofar as he gave detailed instructions as to how to position oneself in the ring in order to best flummox one's opponent. And he was also another exemplar insofar as he was able to parlay the funds, the purses that he received fighting, say, in Nevada, into certain kinds of investments for his family and his community in his own Baltimore. And you see that as a repetitive theme with regard to boxers, not just Black boxers, but boxers in general. That is to say, oftentimes they're able to accumulate a fair amount of wealth, exploitation set aside, and then that wealth is parlayed into investments, which then boost themselves and oftentimes their family members and associates and comrades on the class ladder, which then disrupts the existing race come class status quo, undermines the existing race come class status quo. And of course, in the case of Muhammad Ali, is able to attract by dint of his magnetic personality many younger people who then follow in his footsteps with regard to opposing the war in Vietnam, being anti-establishment or perceived as such, I should say, et cetera.
In regards to the exploitation within boxing, could we get into the element of racketeering? Because I feel like at times, even though there's been many trials related to match fixing, it seems like sometimes the sort of criminal, unseemly element of boxing and the exploitation of these boxers can get overlooked. People just want to, I guess, enjoy the fight. But I think the sort of behind-the-scenes story of boxing and the exploitation of these boxers is, incredibly interesting and important. And I think we also see it even in other combat sports, whether it be wrestling or mixed martial arts. We see a lot of these competitors, they're not really allowed to form unions. They're taken advantage of by their bosses. They're underpaid. Maybe you could comment on that aspect of exploitation going on in boxing.
Well, what's interesting about boxing, among other things, is that some of the themes you've just sketched are reflected in cinema. Requiem for a Heavyweight, Body and Soul, for example. There have been a number of very good boxing movies where organized crime plays more than a minor role. which then again reflects reality, because boxing is a sport that's particularly susceptible to corruption, insofar as oftentimes you only have to corrupt one person. That is to say, one boxer. You don't even have to corrupt two boxers. Whereas if you look at the scandals in baseball, like the so-called Black Sox scandal involving the Chicago White Sox in the 1919 World Series, they had to corrupt more than one player, obviously. And the same holds true for other kinds of sports, say football, basketball, et cetera. And so because of the cruel exploitation, the fact that many of these boxers are coming out of poverty-stricken backgrounds, it makes them uniquely susceptible to being corrupted. And then you have a sport and a society where organized crime is a material force. As I noted a few moments ago, wrote an entire book about its influence in popular music, particularly the music we call jazz. And like any entrepreneurs or capitalists, organized crime figures seek to expand their business empire. So why should they be limited only to music or nightclubs or waste collection, which is one of their specialties nowadays? Inevitably, they spread their tentacles into boxing. One of the problems arose post-World War II when you had the confluence of the agonized retreat of Jim Crow, U.S. apartheid. At the same time, you still had a number of prominent Black boxers. And so you saw the heavyweight champion, Joe Louis, who is the kind of middle figure between Jack Johnson and Muhammad Ali. He's the heavyweight champion in the 1930s and the 1940s. And so by the 1950s, he wants to move into promotion. And as I talk about in the book, because many of the bases are occupied by organized crime figures, he has to cut deals with these figures. He has a comrade by the name of Truman Gibson, who is a well-trained Black American lawyer, who becomes not only Joe Louis's front man, but also the interlocutor with organized crime figures. And what happens is predictable. Truman Gibson eventually is indicted, but not before helping to bring boxing onto the boob tube. Television explodes as a consumer item in the late 1940s, early 1950s, implanted in virtually every living room. The networks are looking for product or looking for something to fill time on the air, which leads to boxing being regularly on the boob tubes, sometimes two or three times a week. And this attracts the ravenous attention of other capitalist entrepreneurs, organized crime figures. And eventually, Truman Gibson, Joe Louis's comrade, and his organized crime buddies are indicted, but they're only replaced by other organized crime figures. And as the cycle continues.
In that regard, with that 1961 trial involving Truman Gibson, I found that chapter very interesting, especially towards the end, because I feel like at times in this book, there is this sort of shadow of the political administrations, the presidents and their administrations sort of hovering in the background. And the character of Roy Cohn and William Fugazi comes up. How do these two figures figure into the story?
Well, you are correct to perceive the shadow of politicos, because boxing is subject to regulation. Either a state athletic commission in New York State, and as you might have noted, I did a lot of research in their records, or a similar commission in Nevada, similar commission in California, similar commission in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Minnesota, Arizona, Florida, et cetera. And so when you're talking about regulation, you're talking about the government, which means you're talking about elected officials, which means that you should, if you're going to be successful, have influence with these elected officials. And you should particularly have influence with who becomes the federal prosecutors and the district attorneys. Because if you don't have influence with them, certainly your competitors will. And so once Truman Gibson and his comrades in organized crime are wounded, you see the entry into boxing of similarly odious figures. Speaking of Roy Cohn, who, as you know, becomes a lawyer for Donald J. Trump. It's said that Donald J. Trump learns a number of tricks of the trade from Roy Cohn during his administration. That is to say, Mr. Trump's administration. He once asked, when he's looking for a lawyer with, shall we say, flexible ethics, where's my Roy Cohn, for example? And so Roy Cohn was a figure in boxing for a while, along with William Fugazi, who you also mentioned. And you know, one of the people I quote suggests that if it weren't for a lack of headroom, you probably should schedule boxing matches in sewers, because it's such a dirty, grimy, unprincipled sport. And unsurprisingly, once you have Roy Cohn pass from the scene, it does not mean the end of a lack of ethics in boxing. You get other weasels and barracudas and sharks who take their place.
And I also found right at the end of that chapter, and maybe you could explain this just a little bit, the figure Bernard Barker shows up at the end of that chapter, the Watergate burglar. And I was not expecting to see the Watergate burglar figure into this whole story.
Well, this bespeaks a number of points. One, boxing tends to attract those with flexible ethics. And once you keep that in mind, it should not be surprising that my book is populated by figures like Roy Cohn, Donald J. Trump, Watergate burglars, et cetera. Second, South Florida figures prominently in my book. And Bernard Barker had very close ties to South Florida. And as you recall, the president from whom he toiled, speaking of one Richard Milhouse Nixon, his alternative site other than the White House was not Mar-a-Lago, but Key Biscayne in Florida. And so it's not surprising that figures like Bernard Barker pop up on my pages, nor should it be surprising that Dwight David Eisenhower, the president when Richard M. Nixon was vice president in the 1950s, pops up in my pages, because many political figures find it useful and convenient to associate with certain boxers, because I think that they feel it helps to give them an aura of masculinity themselves, which is thought to be necessary for a male political leader. And second of all, it tends to associate them with sports. And this is a sports mad, sports obsessed society. However, as I point out, interestingly enough, Dwight David Eisenhower, he associated himself more with Ingemar Johansson, the Swedish heavyweight champion of the 1950s, more so than his frequent opponent, Floyd Patterson, a Black American with roots in North Carolina and New York, with whom Johansson had a number of very punishing bouts over the years. And he also associated himself with Rocky Marciano, speaking of President Eisenhower, who retired undefeated, and of course he had his own unique ties to organized crime, died mysteriously in a plane crash, which is a frequent phrase oftentimes used in the United States. And it's not surprising, as already noted, that boxing attracts the dedicated attention of talented screenwriters, because embedded in these stories of boxers are stories that are in many ways larger than life.
If we could, in that regard, your book actually got me to thinking a lot about Sonny Liston. I've seen some of the movies about Sonny Liston, and I've read a lot about him. I talked to a documentarian that did an HBO documentary on Liston. And I think a lot of people, they think of Liston and they think of the scandals like the Phantom Punch. They think of him beating Patterson. They think of his unfortunate death. They think about his shady connections within this world. But I think in a way we lose sight of the human beings when we think of, you know, these boxers in this light. And that's partly because they're celebrities. I think that's done with celebrities in general. But, you know, when you read this book, it gets you to thinking about how people like Sonny Liston were really exploited. I mean, these are human beings that are put in the ring, putting their bodies on the line, and often being exploited by the most insidious characters imaginable. And we often lose sight of that human element. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with me on that.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's really a sad and tragic tale. Liston, with roots in Jim Crow Arkansas, takes the short migration with his family due north to St. Louis. He is blessed with having big hands, which somehow leads him, before entering boxing, into the rather dirty business of being a labor goon, that is to say, helping to break up strikes, for example, on behalf of organized crime figures in St. Louis. That leads him into the ring, and St. Louis plays a major part in this book because, like so many other cities, it's a citadel of organized crime. I mean, it's interesting, in my jazz book, Kansas City plays that role because it too is a citadel of organized crime, as is Chicago, as is Detroit, as is New York, as is South Florida, as is Nevada, et cetera. In any case, Sonny Liston is catapulted into prominence when he defeats Floyd Patterson. And what's interesting about Sonny Liston, it seemed like he was knocking out early in the fight many of his opponents, including quite notoriously Roy Harris from Cut and Shoot, Texas, in the late 1950s, who of course happened to be a Euro-American man. And that particular quick undressing of Roy Harris helps to contribute to the notorious image of Liston as being a kind of beast in the ring, which many, as noted, literate sports writers latch on to that particular image. And so going into the bout with the then Cassius Clay, soon to be Muhammad Ali, in 1964, it was expected that Liston would emerge triumphant. Of course, there was scuttlebutt and rumor, and I'm not able to confirm it, that there was some dirty business going on. That is to say, that a number of gamblers made a small fortune by assuming that Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay, would win, because all the money was going in the opposite direction. And then there was the succeeding fight in Lewiston, Maine, which also ends controversially. And Sonny Liston, by that point, towards the end of his life, is living in mob-infested Las Vegas, which is not necessarily the place you want to live if you're a boxer with organized crime connections, because organized crime wields undue influence in the erstwhile Silver State. And so, of course, he dies rather mysteriously, supposedly from a drug overdose, although there are those in Las Vegas who suggest that they didn't even believe he used drugs. So there you have it.
It's interesting when we talk about these mob connections as well. I noticed that you mentioned in passing the work of Don Folsom, who wrote a book called The Mafia's President, about Richard Nixon. I think it's rather interesting that we have these sort of right-wing sort of operatives like Roger Stone over the years really pushing this narrative that, oh, the mob, they're tied in with the unions and the Democrats. And it really takes the focus off the fact, I think, that, you know, these mob figures are essentially capitalists.
Well, that's for sure. Speaking of books, I don't know if I quoted it in my book, but I know in my Hollywood books, I quoted the work of, I think he's now passed away, Dan Moldea, M-O-L-D-E-A.
Dan is still alive. I've been trying to get him on the show. Dark Victory, a very brilliant book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's still alive, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I mean, he did work on the Teamsters. A very good investigator. And I think that you're correct to suggest that these organized crime figures are, they're no more than capitalists. I mean, look at Las Vegas, for example. Look at the casinos. I mean, once again, I think Hollywood has done a decent job with regard to the movie Bugsy, for example. Talking about Bugsy Siegel and the creation of Las Vegas as a sin capital post-World War II, post-1945, is basically at the behest of organized crime figures that takes off like a rocket after the Cuban Revolution, 1959, because Havana had been the previous sin capital for many of these figures, but then they're ousted unceremoniously in 1959, and then they all flock to Nevada, and particularly Las Vegas. And that's when you begin to see when Reno is eclipsed by Las Vegas in Nevada itself. And so I'm sure Roger Stone knows better. I guess he's just trying to throw dust in the eyes of the public.
Well, it's interesting as well, because I think, you know, these figures like Stone, they've been involved with the Reagan administration and all these different Republican administrations, including Trump. And we always hear about any type of regulation will lead to socialism or communism. That's the sort of scare tactic. What's really interesting about this book is you look at the sort of Reagan era, the deregulate everything mentality, and you look at the world of boxing. And when you look at the world of boxing, you see there's no regulation here. Could you talk about that and how the unregulated world of boxing mirrors this political world that we've had, especially since the Reagan presidency?
Well, you see this particularly, I think I have a vignette in there, and I'm talking about the authorities in Indianapolis and in Indiana are trying to track down a notorious promoter and taking advantage of federalism. That is to say, in the United States, you have this federal system, you have 50 different states. Then within the states, you have various municipalities with powers of their own. And so this allows the slimy entrepreneur to engage in a kind of arbitrage. So in the case that I'm referring to, you can have a promoter who's under fire in Indiana and simply moves into Kentucky, due south. Or you will have a promoter who's under fire, even in Nevada, and moves into California. Or you'll have boxers who will box in one city under the name of Joe Jones and in another city under the name of Joe Jonas. And the lack of a centralized federal authority, and instead having dozens of different authorities, allows for the system to be gamed and the system to be manipulated to the detriment of these fighters. Now, of course, understandably, in my book, I talk about a number of the well-known names, Jack Johnson and Muhammad Ali, but I've spent a lot of time talking about the not so well-known names, people, boxers who leave the ring with brain damage, for example, boxers who leave the ring with eye damage, for example, or for that matter, how certain referees can be bribed quite easily. That's another way that a gambler can make out like a bandit with regard to a boxing match. Or alternatively, you'll see referees playing to the bloodlust of the audience, will not stop fights, allowing fighters to be killed in some cases. I mean, one of the sub-themes of this book are the countless number of boxers who've been killed in the ring. I mean, the most notorious example, perhaps, comes in 1962 in Madison Square Garden, when the champion welterweight Emil Griffith is battling the Cuban-born Benny Paré, and the latter had used a homophobic slur to describe the ultimate victor, Mr. Griffith. And so in the ring, he was full of fury, speaking of Griffith, and he systematically executes his opponent in the ring. And the referee probably should have stopped the fight, but did not, playing to the bloodlust of the audience. And so boxing, to a certain degree, exhibits a kind of Wild West mentality with not enough regulation, quite frankly. It needs more regulation. It needs more centralized authority in order to curb this arbitrage of various jurisdictions. You need boxers organized in unions, for example. You need boxers organized in unions so that they will have pensions, for example, because their careers rarely last beyond the age of 35. And that's probably an exaggeration. Let's say beyond the age of 30 or 31. And oftentimes, because of the damage they suffered in the ring, they're not useful in terms of finding other kinds of jobs or occupations. So this sport is a kind of mess right now. And my book deals with that in part.
Before we close out, one thing that I find interesting about this book is I was thinking in terms of other combat sports, whether we're talking about UFC and MMA, or even something like pro wrestling. UFC, they claim that their athletes are not employees, they're independent contractors. Pro wrestling is notorious for this. They don't allow wrestlers in the major promotions really to do work outside of one promotion. They say they're independent contractors, but they're really not allowed to do anything outside of what they're told to do within their organization. And I feel like boxing has this similar issue where they're independent contractors. They don't really have rights. And like in wrestling and UFC, although I'm a little bit less aware of the UFC situation, it seems like none of these sort of combat sports have any unions.
Well, you know, surprise, surprise. I mean, obviously that makes them more susceptible to exploitation. If they had unions, of course, they would have a countervailing power, a counterweight that hopefully could go chin to chin and toe to toe with organized crime, for example, with the promoters like Bob Arum and Don King, for example. But you see this as just being typical of U.S. society, which at least since the rise of Reaganism in the 1980s, has been furiously anti-union and helps to account for why real wages have not risen substantially since the 1980s. And boxers are just one more example of exploited labor. Perhaps one of the more dramatic and egregious examples of exploited labor, but exploited labor nonetheless, which leads me to suspect that if somehow we could organize boxers into the formidable political and labor force that they should be, it would be a gigantic step forward in terms of organizing other forms of exploited labor, from Uber and Lyft drivers to the people who stock grocery shelves, to truck drivers, to steel workers, to teachers. And of course, some of those sectors are unionized, but have been weakened with the rise of Reaganism. And so I think that it's appropriate to mention that boxers are simply one more form of organized exploitation.
I'd like to try to end on a positive note. So I want to mention someone who gave a blurb to your book, namely David Zarin, who's the sports editor at The Nation magazine. And David has written a great deal and uncovered a great deal about athletes and their sort of potential for radical politics or politics that really oppose the establishment. And he's done multiple articles and books on this. Do we see this in boxing as well? Are there boxers? I mean, Ali, of course, Muhammad Ali, but are there a number of other boxers we can look to who historically have opposed things like Jim Crow and other injustices?
Well, I spent a lot of time during our brief talk talking about Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson. I've spent less time talking about Joe Louis. In some ways, even though it's not part of his ordinary biography, but in some ways he was really more politicized than either Johnson or Ali. And this reflects another trend. I think he might have been more politicized because he rose to prominence in a more politicized era. Speaking of the 1930s, when organized labor was on the march, when you had the organizing of steel workers, rubber workers, auto workers, the rise of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which organized horizontally, that is to say, they would go into a plant and organize everybody and not just organize the skill workers, which had been the tendency of the American Federation of Labor. And Joe Louis benefited from that enhanced, increased consciousness. He benefited from anti-fascism. The United States was enmeshed in an anti-fascist war during the height of his championship reign, 1941 to 1945. He toured U.S. military bases who were fighting the Nazis, particularly in Italy and in Europe. He was a close comrade of the late, great Paul Robeson. In fact, your listeners may want to find online the Count Basie Paul Robeson tune, King Joe, celebrating Joe Louis. Joe Louis endorsed Henry A. Wallace, the last serious third-party candidate for presidency. Henry A. Wallace had been vice president under FDR, for example. This presidential race was in 1948. And so Joe Louis, even though he ended, shall we say, on a sour note, the government was after him. The government basically plundered and looted him, leaving him to spend his declining days as a greeter at a Las Vegas casino. If not for the financial assistance, sadly, of certain organized crime figures and certain entertainers and celebrities, he might have ended up homeless. But having said that, I think Joe Louis, during his heyday in the 1930s and the 1940s, is a figure well worth studying, particularly by younger boxers.
Final question, I promise to let you go after this. I think there's a lot listeners can get out of this book, and we've covered a lot of it here, just looking at the politics of some of these boxers, looking at the exploitation and seeing how we can apply that to other aspects and sectors of society. But one thing I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that there used to be a really thriving labor movement. We don't really have that anymore. What really is the future for people that feel that there's something wrong, there's growing inequality, the sort of racial liberal consensus hasn't provided true racial justice as of yet, and I think people are getting upset by it. They want to see change, but it seems like we don't have the same kind of movements we did in the past, I sometimes get very discouraged. Do you think that's being too pessimistic, or do you think that there is hope? What can we do in the future to build movements?
Well, yes, there's hope. Where there's life, there's hope. I understand why there might be a bit of pessimism now, even with the defeat of Trumpism, because we know that it might not be that difficult for Trumpism to make a comeback in 2022 or 2024, which is why I think we need to be as busy as beavers right now, constructing anti-conservative, anti-fascist fortifications, because we know, and it has been promised, that the storm is coming. And I think that we also need to look at the fact that even though the press, at least the corporate media, hasn't covered it very well, there have been an extraordinary number of pandemic strikes, as you might call them, and labor actions, you might call them. As we speak, we're expecting a victory with regard to Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama, in the heart of conservatism, the heart of the Deep South. And so I think that if we play our cards properly, and if we emulate some of the better boxers who had their opponents turn into vectors of their opponent's defeat, that is to say, they box so well defensively, they had their opponents defeat themselves.
And they so rope and doped them.
Exactly. So if we can take some of those principles and apply them to our most formidable opponents, I think we'll come out smelling like roses.
Well, Gerald Horn, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners get a copy of The Bittersweet Science, and how can they keep up with your work?
Well, rather than point listeners to a service which I just scorned with regard to labor organizing, I would point them to two sources. One, the publishers, international publishers in New York. Of course, a simple search will reveal how to reach them. Or Esowon Bookstore in Los Angeles, E-S-O-W-O-N. It's a Black bookstore in Los Angeles. They handle a lot of my books. So either source would be ideal. And keeping up with me, well, let's see, I'm not underground yet. And so you can find many lectures I've done on YouTube. And of course, I have a Facebook presence as well.
And thank you again, Professor Gerald Horn, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and The Political Economy of Boxing. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.